film, I realized how correct Reese was. When I see a photo in Us Weekly of Angelina Jolie Pitt walking back to her car from the pharmacy, I feel a little irrationally miffed if she's not smiling. She has a great life and like 20 gorgeous kids. Why are you not smiling, Angelina Jolie Pitt? If you're not grinning ear to ear when you're sleeping with Brad Pitt every night, then how shitty is my life? So now I get it, and I have tried to train my face to be a smile in repose instead of the low-level grimace I've worn my entire life. Also, I comb my bangs over my acne and wear aviator sunglasses like Tom Cruise, so people will be really psyched when they see an impromptu paparazzi photo of me. Stars are just like us, but they are super happy and grateful every moment, even when they are picking up UTI medicine. Complain. This is related to frowning. Nobody wants to hear that any aspect of my awesome life is bad. I get that. But there are days, maybe 2 or 3 times a year, when I get completely overwhelmed by my job and go to my office, lie on the floor, and cry for 10 minutes. Then I think, Mindy, you have literally the best life in the world, besides that hot lawyer who married George Clooney. This is what you dreamed about when you were a weird, determined little 10-year-old. There are more than 1,000 people in 1 square mile of this studio who would kill to have this job. Get your ass up off the floor and go back into that writer's room, you weakling. Then I get up, pour myself a generous glass of whiskey and club soda, think about the sustained grit of my parents, and go back to work. I know that makes me sound like a tortured alcoholic like Don Draper, but I swear I'm not. Okay, I'm done complaining, because of course there's lots of cool stuff I get to do now that I'm famous. Things I can do now that I'm a little bit famous. Contact Jai Courtney if I need to. Listen, it's not like I have handsome Australian action star Jai Courtney's phone number on speed dial or anything. But if there was a life or death emergency, or more reasonably, if I was dying and my dying wish was to have make-a-wish style sex with Jai Courtney, I bet I could swing that. My friend Ike knows him. People sometimes send me stuff. For my birthday last year, McDonald's sent me a sweet stack of $10 gift cards. If you follow me on any kind of social media, you will see that I'm constantly eating McDonald's, and not in a campy, skinny actress way, where I go when I'm on my period and being bad. I go regularly enough that the women at the Crescent Heights and Sunset McDonald's gives me ranch and buffalo sauce packets for my McNuggets without me having to ask. I think McDonald's was hoping I would share my gift cards with my cast and writers, but I didn't. Guys in prison email me. Ever heard of Corlinks.com? No? Neither had I. Probably because Corlinks is the official email system used by the federal penitentiary system. It's for inmates who want to communicate with the outside world. About 2 years ago, a month after the Mindy Project premiered, my inbox was flooded with emails from this mysterious site called Corlinks, requesting that I accept their invitations for communication. At first, my mind went to cufflinks and I thought it was some fashion-related website. Nope. I guess the Mindy Project was popular in certain federal prisons, and because of that, coupled with the fact that my email address was incredibly easy to guess, I have since changed it, I was getting a lot of requests. At first, I was kind of flattered and amused. I liked thinking of all the guys in the prison rec room quieting down when the show came on. Shut up, you guys, one inmate would menacingly shout to another one who was playing ping pong. I hope Mindy manages to find a good balance between work and dating. Danny is so soulful and closed off, just like my cellmate. Where is the old doctor? Why do they keep changing the cast? The warden isn't looking. Let's riot. But then, just as I was beginning to enjoy it, it became a little scary. I would return from set, and there would be more and more emails requesting to initiate contact with me. Guys with names like Robert Lee and Rufus. I imagine the flip side of an unrequited prison crush is prison rage. I also don't live in any kind of gated community, and my house is very easy to break into. I've broken into it twice when I couldn't find my keys, and I'm not even a hardened criminal, yet. So, with a heavy heart, I went through the process of blocking requests from Corlinks. I do like the distinction that these were federal prisoners trying to contact me, not state prisoners. Federal prisons are way more fancy, so in my mind, these were fairly classy guys. Large-scale drug traffickers and Wolf of Wall Street type guys, rather than stab and grabbers. I mean, no offense to stab and grabbers, especially hot ones. Be compared to other famous women. One rite of passage I experienced is that I am now known enough to be featured on a magazine's Who Wore It Best page. Who Wore It Best is incredibly popular because we, as consumers, are not completely satisfied with our scrutiny of women's appearances in TV and film. We also find it enjoyable to pit women against each other in fashion Hunger Games. To determine who wore it best, a group of strangers is polled on the street on their way to lunch somewhere in Midtown Manhattan. If I've learned anything from watching TV, it's that stopping people on a busy Manhattan street is the fairest and most democratic way to get the true answer to something. Who wore the Stella McCartney dress better? A tired magazine intern asks, presenting two photos of actresses wearing the same dress and secretly wondering if taking a semester off from college to work at this publication was the best use of her time. Was it comedy TV actor Mindy Kaling? Or was it internationally famous supermodel Giselle? After hours of asking people this question, the results are in. 99% think Giselle wore it better. 1% say Mindy wore it better, and that was a blind woman who was looking for a bathroom. I can actually save the magazine editors behind Who Wore It Best some time. Here's the answer 100% of the time. It's always the more famous or classically beautiful woman. I laugh thinking about if they ever tried to do Who Wore It Best for men's magazines. They wouldn't, because no one would care. Men don't care which men look better in the same clothes, because it's obviously a huge waste of time. It's also why they don't have astrology sections in men's magazines. Come on, women's magazines, get it together. Cool women want to be my friend. One very gratifying compliment I sometimes hear is that women want to be my best friend. This endlessly amuses my actual best friend, Jocelyn, because in her estimation, I'm a great friend, but not that great. Here are the pros of being best friends with me. I am one of the best people that you could take to your ex-boyfriend's birthday party that you are dreading going to. I am always up for dessert. I am always up for skinny dipping. If you want to talk to any hot guy at a party, I will so be that girl who gets drunk and introduces us, then inches away so you can roll your eyes about me and sell me out so you can bond with him. I will dance almost anywhere with anyone. I have one of the sickest closets of clothes. And I will let you borrow anything and spend hours doing fashion shows in my bedroom with you. There are no cons. Changing people's lives. The single best outcome of my minor fame is that women, usually young women who feel marginalized for some reason, come up to me or write to me to tell me I make them feel more normal. That is profoundly moving to me. I'm not saying I'm some kind of pioneer here, like Indian Dorothy Dandridge or whatever, but I love that. I'm a role model now. It makes all the stuff I can't do anymore completely worth it. It's actually the way that my minor fame has changed me the most. I want to be a better person because I don't want to disappoint those girls. I stop and think about my actions more. I tip great. I try not to swear too much. And I remember to thank people and be grateful. And all that stuff I do to appear better has actually made me a better person. I wish I had always acted like I was a little bit famous. Things to bring to my dinner party. If I host a dinner party at my house that you are invited to, then first of all, congratulations. You are living in a thrilling science fiction world where robots probably walk among humans as equals, and also, I know how to cook. I spent a great deal of my youth fantasizing about entertaining. In my early 20s, I would spend hours poring over cookbooks at the 7th Avenue Barnes & Noble in Park Slope, planning elaborate parties that I would throw when I was older and had money. Now I am older and have money, but I almost never entertain. I have yet to throw my Great Gatsby-themed Super Bowl viewing party, but when I do, it will be a big hit, as will be my Daisy Buchanan slow cooker chicken enchiladas. It's more than 10 years later, and in some ways, I am the person I hoped I'd turn out to be when I was 23. I mean, I hoped I would be married to a Laker and have an Oscar and an ass that doesn't quit, but I'm doing pretty well. I do not, however, throw nearly enough dinner parties, but if I ever do, you will never be asked to bring anything. I believe the potluck tradition of entertaining is the equivalent of a teenage boy wanting to have sex with his girlfriend, but who is too scared to go to CVS to buy condoms. If you can't handle providing all the courses for your dinner party, you can't handle the hosting duties of a dinner party. However, if you feel like bringing the following non-food items, boy, will you be my favorite guest. Here's what I suggest you bring. A great story about a near-death experience. Did you ever get mugged at gunpoint on the subway late at night? Did you ever almost fall over the ledge of the Grand Canyon Skywalk? Did you ever have dinner at a restaurant the same night a serial murderer also ate there? Are you a ghost? Tell that story, please. A great story about a scandalous celebrity experience. Did you ever hook up with Jimmy Fallon before he was famous? And was he into something in bed that would surprise and titillate us? Oh my, please go on. My mail from my mailbox. Thanks, bud. Just leave it on the counter. You're a good friend. An old picture of Colin Firth you found. Ooh la la. No need for dessert, am I right? Don't worry, there's obviously also dessert. A new kind of hot sauce that you want to introduce me to. I eat hot sauce on approximately 70% of my meals. Learning about new hot sauces is the least expensive way to improve my quality of life. Remember when I tried Sambal Oleg and I couldn't shut up about it? This is a very thoughtful gift that shows a deep understanding of your hostess. Your ukulele to play a song after dinner. But please, classic tunes only, like Over the Rainbow, or songs that would sound funny on the uke, like Sam Smith's Stay With Me. No original music allowed. You know I can't stand original music. Please just stick to the hits. This is a celebratory event, not an open mic night at the campus events hall. An enormous vintage diamond engagement ring that you're giving to me because you're going to announce at dinner that I am yours. I can't believe it. I'm being proposed to at my own fussy dinner party, even though I had all these irritating restrictions? I'm the luckiest girl on earth. And lastly, a huge appetite and a cheerful tolerance for solid B-minus cooking. Just a friendly reminder, I truly cannot cook. Player. I was at a friend's birthday party at one of those bars in downtown LA where the cocktail waitresses have to dress up like Sally Bowles and take your drink orders in character. I was 25 and pretending to like the taste of absinthe. I had just been dumped by Nate, a guy I had dated briefly. Nate was a comedy writer I had met at the gym. Every week or so, he would wander over while I was on the elliptical machine and make small talk. Well, small talk for a comedy writer, which meant asking me nervously about some perceived environmental hazard at our gym. Once he asked if I thought there was asbestos coming out of the air conditioner duct. Another time, if the towels smelled like mildew. Every time, I told him no. I never think environmental hazards are going to kill me. I only think serial killers are. After months of thinking he was simply a friendly hypochondriac whose neuroses extended to bothering strangers while they did cardio, Nate asked me out. He turned out to be cooler than I thought, and I was impressed by his opinions about movies and music. He liked nothing unless he knew someone personally involved. I was 25. This was a cool attitude to have then. But after 2 months of dating, he stopped calling me. Perhaps it was because I was never as alarmed about our health safety as he was. Maybe it was because it was clear I wasn't going to have sex with him for months and months. Again, I was 25. Maybe he just thought I was lame. I will never know. It surprisingly hurt my feelings because I made the mistake of talking about him excitedly to all my friends, and then it was over. So it was not a great night at the Sally Bowles bar. It was a birthday party for a friend of a friend. But the first friend ended up not being able to go, so I was stuck with a room full of strangers. I could have bailed, but I was feeling a little lonely and therefore susceptible to a naive spurt of positivity, where I convinced myself, who cares if I don't know anyone? That's the only way to meet someone. Of course, Nate was there, and he was making animated chit-chat across the bar with a briefcase model from Deal or No Deal. She didn't have her briefcase with her or anything, but people kept marveling about it. Something about having the prop of a briefcase made this model go from simply hot to hot and interesting. It was like the briefcases were fooling people into thinking that all these models were not human display cases, but in fact, accomplished businesswomen. I was wearing a black pinafore-style dress with a long-sleeve t-shirt underneath, which, when I was getting dressed at home, seemed very stylish and French. But suddenly, in the face of the unabashed hotness of a Deal or No Deal girl, I felt like a middle-aged au pair for a family in the Pacific Palisades. I was nursing an absinthe because, though I loathe any alcoholic drink that isn't brimming with maraschino cherries, this was the specialty drink of the venue, and I was in the kind of mood where I desperately wanted to fit in. After 15 minutes of trying to make friendly eye contact with people and failing, I sighed and decided it was time to go home, figuring that if I left now, I could pick up a Filet-O-Fish from the McDonald's drive-thru and still catch Weekend Update on SNL. The number of times that I have bailed on something on a Saturday night with the hopes that I could be, quote, home in time for Weekend Update, is in the dozens. Somehow, if I made it back in time to see Amy Poehler and Tina Fey's take on the news, the night would not have been a total bust. I was pulling cash out of my clutch to pay when I saw her. It is the east, and Greta is the sun. Entering the speakeasy was a beautiful pale girl with long, shiny blonde hair, dressed in torn jeans and Converse, a plaid shirt tied sloppily around her shoulders. She was the only girl in the bar not wearing heels, and definitely the only person at the bar besides the busboys wearing sneakers. She carried an enormous Chanel bag. She was at once underdressed and overqualified for this party, and was instantly the coolest person there. She made eye contact with me, smiled, waved, and headed toward me. I smiled back. I did not know her. Had we gone to high school together? Was she that friendly, nameless girl who got me a glass of water when I had my hair cut? I blotted my shiny cheeks and nose, suddenly sweating like I do when I meet a guy I like. Am I gay? I thought, wondering why was I so nervous? When she finally made her way to me at the bar, she stopped and covered her mouth with her hands in a look of utter delighted shock. I'm sorry, she said. Can I just hug you, please? We don't know each other, but I'm obsessed with you. Puzzled, but incredibly flattered, I nodded. She then gave me the warmest and sweetest-smelling hug I have ever received. My name is Greta, she said, and we are going to be best friends. One thing you should know about me is that I am not a hugger. For the record, in New York, that is a perfectly acceptable way to be. If you hug someone there, they are either a person in your immediate family, whom you have not seen in months, or they are gravely ill. In Los Angeles, however, if you're not hugging everyone hello and goodbye, you are considered to be a total asshole with anger problems. But Greta's embrace was so full of love, and I was so sad and insecure that it was like being wrapped in the coziest blanket. Greta became my date for the evening, and was the wing woman I had always wanted. She was pretty enough to be an actress, but thought the idea was absurd. She was, from what I could tell, some kind of freelance creative producer slash consultant slash tastemaker. Someone whispered to me that she was fourth-generation Yao, but had dropped out to work for MTV in Hong Kong. She knew everyone at the party, and from what I could see, everyone was delighted to see her. And though this was the first time I had ever met her, she was giving me career advice with a kind of confidence that made me feel like it was 100% correct. Greta introduced me to people and then pulled me aside after. You must get coffee with Stacy. She's stylish, she gets it, she's someone you should know. I nodded, taking this very seriously. She's someone you should know. I had never heard this phrase, and now it was the most important phrase in my life. About Nate and the deal or no deal girl, Greta rolled her eyes and assured me, you have nothing to worry about. She's just a Tiffany in American Apparel leggings. You've outgrown Nate anyway. Her name is Tiffany, I asked. Greta wrinkled her nose. No, Tiffany is her essence. She did not know Nate, and she did not know me, but I believed her, because I liked the idealized version of me that she saw, even though we were strangers. Whatever Greta saw, that's what I wanted to be. We spent the evening at the bar laughing and drinking, and we exchanged phone numbers. She texted me on the way home. Greta's text. Nate Ken, open parentheses, underscore, X, underscore, end parentheses. My text. What? Greta's text. Kiss my butt. I felt a tugging in my chest, and I recognized it as love. At long last, my long-lost love. The week after I met Greta, I started the hiatus between seasons 1 and 2 of The Office, which is like our summer vacation. Greta was suddenly with me everywhere. She was always available to hang out, and when we did, she was a blast. It is not hard to have fun with someone who thinks you are the funniest and most fabulous celebrity she has ever met. But she wasn't just some random sycophant. Greta told me when I wore an outfit that was unflattering, which is how I knew she was real. And she would do it in the best way anyone had ever given me an insult. You have so much more to offer than that skirt. Find a skirt that deserves you. But her candor did not make her edgy or cynical. Quite the opposite. Greta was so sweet, she was completely intoxicating. She never seemed to dislike or hate anything. No movie or TV show, no matter how bad it was. We saw Poseidon, and as we walked out of the theater, she said, "It must have been challenging to do a movie with so much water." And her positivity had a great effect on me. I was no longer the frowning comedy writer with my arms crossed in skepticism. I liked things. It was so nice to have someone in my life who was not caustic or judgmental. Greta was also a massive resource for all things Los Angeles, having moved there from New York with her family when she was 12. When I complained of being tired, Greta recommended her, quote, exhaustion guy. She wasn't like my lame parents who said, "I need to sleep more and eat better to combat tiredness." Greta's solution was pharmaceutical and therefore much more fun. She recommended that I get B-complex shots from a guy she knew named Doug. Doug was not exactly a doctor, but he had some kind of degree, and he kept his prices low by using the storage closet of a Culver City health food store as his clinic. I was willing to try anything that would make me feel better and required no lifestyle changes, so Doug was a great solution. It also helped that Greta mentioned Doug was the exhaustion guy for a handful of energetic and skinny celebrities I admired, one of whom I had seen in my spinning class destroying a mere 2 weeks after giving birth naturally. If I ever give birth naturally, never going to happen, I will never sit upon a bike again. I'm not very in touch with my body, but I would never do that to my vagina. The clinic was windowless and no bigger than a handicapped bathroom stall at Chili's. I sat around for 15 minutes, looking at all the boxes of Latisse and facial injectables available for purchase. Doug appeared, clad in an Infliction waffle knit tee and True Religion jeans. It was 2006, so this was actually pretty cool. Doug was very busy and a little brusque. He said he was only seeing me because you're friends with Greta. Without asking me any of my medical information, he swiped an alcohol wipe over my love handle, gave me a quick jab of B-complex, and told me to come back next week. When I tried to pay, he shook his head. "I take care of Greta's people." It had only been a month, but I was now one of Greta's people. This was my favorite club. Arielle and Amanda and Kiara and Kelsey. Greta had an enormous group of girlfriends. They were all vivacious LA girls with lots of style and personality, all involved in offshoots of Hollywood entertainment, with many specific things in common. They were incredibly rich, thin, white, and in search of meaning in their lives. I found myself sitting cross-legged on the floors of living rooms of mansions all over Los Angeles, attending trunk shows and book clubs and self-empowerment classes in homes with catered lunches where no one ate but me. Greta's girlfriends would tell bawdy stories in white jeans and had old, ugly husbands. I absolutely loved it. I had no friends like this at all, people so quintessentially L.A. My friends were all neurotic brown-haired people from the tri-state area or New England, yuck. And their names, oh, the names. Greta's friends had the best names. Arielle, the jewelry designer. Kiara, the celebrity makeup artist. Amanda, the hand model. Kelsey, who ran PR for a clothing brand of slutty sweaters that are very popular. I was in girly name heaven. When you grow up with the name Mindy, it's not the best. In addition to a lifetime of gym teachers trying to create rapport with you by asking, "How's Mork doing?" it doesn't have the frilly femininity of names I really coveted. Mindy is the name of a bank teller or a babysitter, but not even the hot babysitter you hope will tell you about French kissing. Mindy is the responsible babysitter who makes you do your homework and go to bed before cheers. Meanwhile, my real best friend Jocelyn, who lived in New York, was getting mildly irritated by photos of Greta and me surfacing on Facebook. Jocelyn has been my best friend from the first week of college. She and I had lived together all through Dartmouth, and then in New York City for 3 years before I moved to Los Angeles. She would come to my parents' home for Thanksgiving every year, and I am now the godmother to her son. She's an excellent example of what a hip-hop artist might call a, quote, ride-or-die bitch, and I missed her. I missed female friendship. I had no real girlfriends in the year I moved to Los Angeles from New York. My only pals were my work friends, and they were mostly older married guys who barely understood their phones. "Who the hell is Greta?" Jocelyn asked one Sunday afternoon on the phone. "Why did she tag you in a photo album called Besties?" she demanded. Jocelyn and I had long made fun of terms like besties and BFFs. To us, they signified the infantilization of women, and we were way too sophisticated for that. But hanging out with Greta had dulled my critical eye because, frankly, it felt good to be called someone's bestie. And when had a critical eye ever helped me, really? Nobody likes the girl who points out all the inherent sexism on The Bachelor, but people are charmed by the girl cavilling about nail art, boba tea, and the homeopathic benefits of ayahuasca. The vaccination trap. I was at a baby shower with Greta for an extremely famous pop singer. The pop singer had turned her enormous backyard into a miniature World's Fair for children, complete with gluten-free everything, and a woman whose job it was to do face paint designs so intricate they rival the work done on Pirates of the Caribbean. However, the children were not having a good time. The reason? One little girl had been jumping on the trampoline, and when she touched the metal frame, which had been sitting in the sun, she screamed it was too hot and burst into tears. She was subsequently circled by adults examining her, quote, burned leg, which turned out to be nothing. The damage was done, however. Now none of the children at the party would touch anything for fear of being burned to death. The party moved inside, where there is nothing to do but drink. Unfortunately for me, nothing to do but drink tends to mean nothing to do but get in trouble. I drink when I don't know a lot of people, which is a useful habit that I picked up in college. When I'm a bit tipsy, I am instantly cheerful and not so socially anxious. The key is that I can drink no more than two drinks, because after that, I go from making charming small talk to slurred rants. Three champagnes in, the pop singer brought up that she was firing her pediatrician and asked if anyone could recommend a doctor. One of my acquaintances from college, Asha, was a pediatrician in Santa Monica, so I excitedly recommended her, thinking this would be a beginning of a lifetime of Asha and me getting free tickets to see the pop star at the Staples Center. Imagine me and Asha being pulled up on stage to get sung to. Why would I be invited, you ask? As the middleman, of course. The pop star said, "Oh, that's so great. I'm really looking for someone young and cool. My last guy had really antiquated ideas." I said, "Asha is the best and very young and cool. Unless, of course, you don't want to get your kids vaccinated, ha ha ha." The pop star froze and everyone went silent. Greta looked at me, eyes widening in horror. I could not have offended a group of people more quickly than if I had announced to a room of male comedy writers that the movie Caddyshack sucks, which I have done and which did not go over very well. The point is, people were incredibly offended. The pop star responded icily, "I'm actually leaving my pediatrician because of his outdated position on vaccinations and autism." Now, if I had been one champagne in, I could have backtracked so deftly. You would think I was Michael Jackson moonwalking across the stage on his bad world tour. Even two champagnes, and I could have charmed my way out of this by pretending I was being ironic the whole time. But not three. Three glasses of anything alcoholic is like truth serum for me. I said, slurrily, "Oh God, pop star, say it ain't so. Say you aren't one of those crazy Hollywood people who doesn't believe in vaccination." I glanced at Greta. Greta's gaze was to the ground. "Oh no." Popstar responded, "Actually, I am." Within 90 seconds, Greta and I were in her Fiat and were headed south in Doheny out of the hills. I could see the worry pass over her eyes as we drove home. What will Mindy say about at-home births? Kabbalah? My psychic? She was silent and turned up the Justin Timberlake. We didn't even stop for frozen yogurt on the way home. It was the closest to furious I had ever seen her. After that, the frayed edges of Greta's and my relationship became more apparent. Her sweetness and accommodating personality also extended to beliefs that I ridiculed, even thought were bad for humanity. Still, Greta was all about forgiveness and getting over stuff. I had messed up, but she would look past it. She hugged me before I got out of the car and said she would call. I breathed a sigh of relief. Gone, baby, gone. At the end of July, work started up again at the office. I was back on the schedule of 6 a.m. call times and staying in the writer's room until 9 p.m. We still grabbed dinner or got exhaustion shots sometimes, but I couldn't go with Greta to screenings and baby showers anymore. In the beginning, Greta was fine with my busyness. We kept in close touch, texting at least 20 times a day. But then, as the weeks went by, I heard from Greta less and less. She told me she was working more, though for the life of me, I still could not pinpoint exactly what her job was. One weekend in September, I was miffed that she couldn't get ice cream teas with me. I texted, "I miss you," and "Why are we not getting frozen yogurt together right now?" Using all the emoticons Greta herself had taught me. But more and more, my texts went unanswered. Once, I read down our text chain and saw she had written the exact phrase, "Hey, QT, love you, miss you, XOXO," 3 times, like it had been copied and pasted. In mid-October, on Facebook, I saw photos of Greta after booty ballet class with a gorgeous actress in her early 20s, whom I recognized as the former second lead on a Disney Channel show I will call Dixie Pepard, Secret Singer-Songwriter and Witch. Greta was tagged, and the caption was, "Doing booty ballet with my BFF. Can barely walk." I clicked on this photo and saw even more photos of Greta and second lead. Greta and second lead in Malibu. Greta and second lead at a Dodgers game. Greta and second lead at a Beverly Hills hair salon getting lobs, long bobs, together. I had been replaced by a younger model, and now they had matching long bobs. The sting of being replaced was very painful. Thank God this was pre-Twitter, because I know I would have tweeted a lot of angry quotes about betrayal, and then later deleted them in a worried state. Greta's phasing me out of her life hurt way more than Nate. Hell, it hurt way more than most breakups I've had, and we were only friends for about 4 months. But as any woman listening to this will attest to, there are not many relationships more powerful than two women who fall fast and deep into friendship. It was heartbreaking to be loved and left. Happily, though, a few months later, work had taken over my entire life, and my friend group was whittled down to the old reliable standbys, Mom, Jocelyn, Brenda, and BJ. As you can imagine, none of them would love the term old reliable standby, so don't tell them if you ever meet them. The great thing about true best friends is that when you go MIA for a few months, they inquire, but they don't press. Best friends know the power of infatuation, but also how quickly it dissipates. You just have to wait it out. And then afterwards, tease them about it for decades. In the past 10 years, I have met a handful of chic and charismatic women in Los Angeles, with whom I have had the telltale spark of being best friend material. It's exciting, like seeing a guy you are really attracted to from across the room at a party. None, however, has managed to infiltrate deep into my best friend group, where they have seen me openly weep, heard me talk shit about my job, or check my scalp for worrisome alopecia spots. But one magical summer, Greta was my best friend. And then, like the guy who spends the night and the next morning tells you, "I honestly feel like I've never met anyone like you before," she was gone. Take this job and love it. How to get your own TV show and nearly die of anxiety. Though I am extremely young, I am old enough to remember must-see TV. For the small handful of listeners who are even younger than me and don't know what I'm talking about, must-see TV refers to the Thursday night lineup on NBC in the 80s and 90s, when you could watch back-to-back amazing, high-quality shows like Cheers, Seinfeld, and Friends. I had the unique experience of being hired to work at NBC in 2004, the year Friends ended, which marked the death of that dynasty. Over the next 8 years, must-see TV went from must-see TV to pretty good TV, to not the worst thing TV, to meh, just watch HBO TV. I was lucky enough to be employed at one of the remaining great NBC shows of the mid-2000s, The Office. Greg Daniels, the creator of the American version of The Office, had plucked me from a strange little off-Broadway play, Matt and Ben, which I had co-written, in which I play Ben Affleck, to write on his show. In 8 years, The Office went from near cancellation to the kind of mainstream and critical success where people come up to you and ask, is Dwight really like that in real life? To which I respond, oh no, Rain isn't like Dwight. Dwight is an angel next to Rain. Rain is a demon. In the fall of 2011, I was feeling pretty good about myself. I had been working on The Office for almost 8 years. I was 31 years old and was one of the few people in TV who felt like I had job stability. As the success of The Office grew, so did my role as writer and producer. And by season 8, I had written 24 episodes. I was invited to be on cool talk shows like The Tonight Show and The Late Show with David Letterman. And Dave and Paul Schaefer didn't even have to pretend to know what show I was on. I got to see my friend BJ Novak daily, which, when we weren't fighting, was the absolute best. Greg and I were nominated for an Emmy for writing the Niagara episode where Jim and Pam get married. But perhaps best of all, I had enough pull that the writer's assistant kept the fridge stocked with my favorite junk foods, Australian red licorice and Pepperidge Farm cinnamon raisin bread, without my even asking. If that isn't success and power, I don't know what is. Most TV writers, even the good ones, aren't usually lucky enough to be employed on a great show. And even great shows get canceled. Most writers have to hop from gig to gig to pay for their Priuses and private schools and divorces. I was an exception. I had what most writers dream of, a consistent source of free lunch for 8 years. I was a member of the core creative team of what some people considered a classic American comedy, with no end in sight. And did I appreciate it? Sometimes? The truth was, I had started growing a little restless. I had a dream job. Was I ungrateful to wonder what more there might be for me? Or complacent if I didn't? The fights in the writer's room and the outcomes that didn't go my way, the one or two great lines a week on camera, and of course the snacks. Was there more to life than an endless supply of Australian red licorice? Okay, obviously not. That stuff's amazing, but you know what I mean. And who was I to try to seek anything better? In high school, I had been cast as a rag picker slash townsperson slash vagrant in 8 consecutive plays. Why would I think I could be anything more than part of an ensemble of anything? These conflicting feelings about my job were illuminating. I was finally experiencing what they call, quote, white people problems. Or, maybe because of my socioeconomic background, this is more of a, quote, first world problem? Or a, quote, one percenter issue. You know what? I can't pinpoint which conflict of privilege I was experiencing, but you get it. The somewhat young and the restless. In television, no matter what your title is, no matter how much you contribute, the only person who has the final say is the showrunner. When you aren't the showrunner on a TV show, you feel like a highly regarded attorney. You work hard, do the research, and argue your case, but the judge, in this case Greg or Paul Lieberstein, who played Toby on the show and became the showrunner after Greg, gets to decide what will actually happen. And though you understand the pecking order and respect the judge, and even if the judge says, great argument, Counselor Kaling, the court concurs, you also just want to not have to plead your case all the time. I wanted to be the judge, jury, and executive producer. See what I did there? Here's a taste of the judge versus attorney dynamic that Paul and I had in the final years of The Office. Paul would give me an assignment, and if I didn't like it, sometimes I would still do it, but sometimes I would do something else. Then I would turn it in and wait for Paul to read it, hoping he would come to my office, full of wonder and appreciation at my risk-taking. Mindy, I'm amazed by you, he would say, awestruck. Not only did you complete the assignment, you reinvented the assignment. You reinvented comedy. Go home. Sleep the sleep of the creatively righteous. Instead, this is what happened. Paul, hey, this is not the assignment I gave you. Me, I didn't believe in the assignment you gave me, so I tried something else, and I'm pretty excited about the results. If I do say so much, Paul, exasperated, I don't care if you don't believe in it. Go do it. I can't imagine how difficult I was to manage back then. I don't think Paul could even have imagined it. I still don't think he believes it. He may have made it into a repressed memory that won't come out until after years of therapy. The truth is, if I had a writer on my staff now who behaved like I did then, I would throw them out the window of the writer's room, move their parking space to Structure C, it's really far away, and make them write 1,000 Morgan Tuker's jokes about when he was in prison. Though I deserved it probably dozens of times, Paul never actually fired me, Or if he did, I never found out about it because we have the same manager. The flip side to our fighting was the fact that I really loved working for him because he was, and is, one of the most gifted writers I know. He was also a great leader, methodical and soft-spoken. Paul talked so quietly that sometimes I couldn't hear him even when I was sitting next to him. I was always leaning in and saying, huh? Huh? It wasn't until later that I realized Paul's quietness was a result of his confidence. He didn't need to shout to be heard. I don't have that kind of confidence. My voice is loud and piercing, and I project like I was once told by a doctor during a childhood illness that I would never speak again. Anyone in a mile radius of our studio recognizes the brittle squawk of Mindy Kaling. I noticed, though, as the years went by, that my passionate arguments became quieter. Part of me attributed it to my maturing and chilling out, but I suspected it might be something more sad. I worried that my well of ideas for what could happen to this group of people working at a small paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania, was going dry. That feeling was also making me antsy. Over the course of the series, I had gone from a gleeful and inexperienced writer who couldn't believe she was in front of the camera to a pretty confident actress. The reason is because I went to the best comedy acting program in the world, the Steve Carell School of Acting. The office was like sitting through a 7-year masterclass on comic acting led by Steve. At the Steve Carell School of Acting, I saw Steve get handed a page-long monologue, glance at it for 20 seconds, and have it memorized. He could go from craft services, where he could be enjoying a cup of tea and telling a funny story, to set, where on cue, he could begin weeping like a faucet. When the director said cut, he would go back to his cup of tea and funny story. I once witnessed him make a room full of actors burst into laughter during a scene by improvising the line, "All right, everybody in the conference room, I don't care if you're gay or straight or lesbian or overweight, just get in there right now." For letting me watch him do all those things, I really ought to send him some money, but honestly, he doesn't need it. He has that sweet, despicable me money. I told my manager, Howard Klein, privately how I felt. And so, at the end of season 7, when my original contract with Universal expired, they hired me to stay on as a writer and actress on The Office and included a development deal for a pilot. A development deal is pretty rad. I got an assistant whose job it was to figure out how the iCloud worked and pretend to be my friend sometimes, but let me yell at her at other times. Basically, I got a chunk of money to keep working on The Office, but also to create a brand new show, which I would write on Sunday afternoons, sitting cross-legged on my bedroom floor with no pants on. My natural assumption was that NBC would put my new show on the air as part of a revitalized must-see TV and make 200 classic episodes, no lazy clip shows, finishing with a 90-minute finale that everyone agreed was a sweet and satisfying send-off. I would emerge from the show's legacy as a modern version of Larry David and Mary Tyler Moore, retiring to a tasteful mega-compound on Martha's Vineyard, where I would write plays and drink wine with Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen at least several times a week. The one thing I was unprepared for was the slightest setback. What could possibly go wrong? The Untitled Mindy Kaling Project. Let's go over my plan, shall we? I was going to write a show starring myself, and it was going to be a smash hit. I would take everything good that I learned at The Office and lose everything that I didn't like about The Office. Mindy Kaling plus Office Good minus Office Bad equals Best Show Ever Made equals me someday receiving a Kennedy Center honor from President Elizabeth Warren. But first I had to assemble all the ingredients I knew a great show had to have. Ingredient number one, a big funny lead. I knew I wanted my character in the new show to be a big comedy character. There are plenty of shows on TV where the lead female exists solely to be the calm, responsible voice of reason. She is often the one keeping the cast of kooky side characters at bay, saying stuff like, "Guys, are you sure this is a good idea?" Or, "You guys go on the road trip and recover the sex tape. I'll stay here on the B story about getting locked in the pantry." My favorite shows have a flawed and ridiculous lead who is steering the comedy of the show, making big mistakes, and then struggling to fix them. Basil Fawlty from Fawlty Towers was my favorite example, as was Idina Menzel from Absolutely Fabulous, and Michael Scott, of course. This was a must. Ingredient 2, a compelling setting. I wanted the audience to enjoy my character's bad behavior, but also feel like she had some redeeming quality, which is the sneaky reason I chose to make Mindy Lahiri a doctor. I felt like if she did terrible things, but hey, she had this noble job where she was delivering babies and saving lives, people would respect her. This trick always works, by the way. This is why every doctor on TV is a drug addict, a sociopath, or just plain mega rude. Doctors can do anything they want. When I was first setting my new show in the world of doctors, I wanted the medical side of it to be front and center. It was my mother, and OBGYN herself, who dissuaded me from that. I went to my mom to ask her about the show. Me. Mom, let's talk about the practical details of your job for research. Mom. No, that's boring. If people want to see medical stuff, they should just watch ER. Me. Mom, that show hasn't been on for years. Why shouldn't I put medical stuff in my show? Mom. Because it's sad. And even when it's happy, it can be gruesome. Me. But shouldn't the show be gritty and realistic? Mom. Here's realistic. When a baby is born, it's covered in blood and strange fluids. Occasionally, it has a cord around its neck, and it's blue, and it's wailing because its little body is cold. The only people who think it's beautiful are its parents, and the doctor is just happy it's alive. And none of that is funny. My mother had a great argument. Plus, I didn't want to hold a prop baby covered in birth slime. If there are two things my mom knew, it was comedy and obstetrics. And that was that. Mom and I always had a shared love of romantic comedies and the version of Manhattan that Nora Ephron and Woody Allen had created for us in You've Got Mail and Annie Hall. She wanted me to play a character from that world. She also wanted to see me in decent clothes for once. While she loved the comedy on The Office, she also commented pretty regularly on how unglamorous it was. Mom, the show isn't supposed to be glamorous. It's supposed to be real, I explained. Like Greg always says, what's beautiful is what's real. What's beautiful can also be what's beautiful, though, she replied. I think there's been some precedent of that in Hollywood. Not a bad point, Mom. She continued, I live real life every day. Why do I need to see it when I come home? And how could I argue with that? Ingredient number 3, literary pretensions. The mini project is most inspired by Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Besides being a structurally perfect novel, Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy are probably my favorite couple in any book. Sidebar, men, if you're still listening, don't worry. We're past the chick lit girl nerd stuff. Coming up, competition, success, money, and sex. Danny Castellano on my show is most based on Mr. Darcy and a generous helping of Sonny Corleone from The Godfather. As for Mindy, Mindy is much less like Elizabeth Bennet than she is a combination of Carrie Bradshaw and Eric Cartman. Many people think romantic comedies are cheesy and boring, but that's only because romantic comedies that come out now are less funny than, say, a card your grandmother might send you for your birthday. People also complain that romantic comedies are formulaic and the ending is always the same. So I wasn't going to do that. Here's what my show would be like. The then called the untitled Mindy Kaling Project. Boy meets girl. Boy hates girl. Girl is not that crazy about boy either. Eventually, girl wears boy down with friendliness. Boy and girl become confidants. Boy grows to love girl but can't express it. Boy and girl get very close to marrying other boys and girls. Boy realizes he was being kind of a dick. Girl realizes she was being judgmental and superficial. Boy and girl have sex. Boy and girl accidentally get pregnant. Boy and girl love each other as best they can and try to live happily ever after. Let's see if that works. Quick and painful rejection. See ya, NBC. I submitted the untitled Mindy Kaling Project to NBC Studios on a Thursday before a weekend I had planned in Palm Springs for my best friend Jocelyn's bachelorette party. I had heard rumors there was some excitement about my script at the studio and assumed I would hear good news by the end of the workday on Friday. But as Saturday of that weekend rolled by, I still hadn't heard anything. Tipsy on margaritas and sleepy on poolside nachos, this was the first uneasy moment in which I considered the possibility that this pilot might not be a go. That night we went to a gay dance club, and while we were all dancing to Rihanna's Rude Boy, I was starting to get worried. It occurred to me that I barely knew the president of the studio at all, and this would be his decision entirely. For the 8 years that I had been there, NBC had been like a dysfunctional African country where the president changed every 11 months or so. Actually, NBC made most African countries look pretty stable by comparison. Except Botswana. I hear really good things about Botswana. That's where the lady's number one detective agency is set. Over the entire run of The Office, there were 7 different people who had run the studio and network. Bob Greenblatt was the newest chief. I had met him briefly at a party once. He was tall and elegant and red-haired. We were friendly, but we were not friends. And now, trapped in Palm Springs, I thought, oh, fuck. Why am I only friendly with Bob Greenblatt? Why did I not force him to become my friend? By the end of Monday, I still had heard nothing. While shooting scenes for The Office, I heard from our writing staff about pilots getting picked up to be filmed. For the first time in 7 years in the TV business, I was completely terrified about my career. Between lighting setups on stage, I called Howard and my agent, Matt Rice, again. They were gentle, but the news was bad. NBC had passed on my pilot. They didn't even like it, or me, enough to shoot it with no intention of ever picking it up. Where was my pity pilot? I told them I totally understood their decision, I didn't, and wasn't surprised. I was surprised, and hung up. And then I sat in my trailer and wept. When you are entitled, you are the most insufferable person ever. If you are entitled and hardworking, which I am, you are still pretty insufferable, but at least you somewhat earned your entitled behavior. For all of my other theoretical faults, no one can deny my powerful and driven work ethic, handed down to me from my immigrant parents and my suburban Boston peer group of kids who thought Cornell was a safety school. I thought it went without saying that I would one day have a show at NBC. It felt like destiny. It's crazily presumptuous, but I always imagined a world where my show was on the same network as my favorite must-see TV shows. And now, it wasn't going to happen. It's weird when you feel your dreams slipping away from you, especially when you have no other dreams. I was surprised that my overwhelming feeling was not sadness, it was terror. What on earth am I going to do now, I thought. The Office isn't going to last forever. Would it end, and would I go work on a lesser comedy? Sitting bitterly in the corner of the rewrite room of My Mismatched Moms, eating a California Pizza Kitchen Thai Crunch salad with peanut dressing on the side, telling people how great my show would have been? Or would I have to take a job as the obligatory ethnic host of House Hunters International, my voiceover gamely trying to maintain the tension of which house will the couple pick, when everyone knows it's the one the wife wants near the beach that's perfect for entertaining? I had reached the level of self-obsessed insanity, at which point no reasonable person would ever feel sorry for me. But sometimes in life, or at least in driver's ed, the best advice is to steer into the curve. It was from this terror that I got an idea. I remembered the man who had been the president of NBC when The Office first started, the man who greenlit The Office when no one else thought it would succeed, and later 30 Rock. That man was Kevin Reilly. Kevin Reilly. The only jock who has ever liked me. Kevin Reilly likes to speak in sports analogies. It's one of the most unsettling things about him, because I am a nerd who doesn't understand anything sports-related at all, except Serena Williams' tennis outfits, which are fierce as hell. Kevin's always saying things like, "You've got a real deep bench now, kid," or, "You just gotta keep your eye on the ball, and then you're gonna push it over the goal line." And I have no idea what he's talking about, I nod enthusiastically and say, "Sure, of course, sports," and hope he doesn't have any follow-up questions. Kevin was always somewhat of a celebrity to me because, as I said, he had greenlit my favorite shows. His championing of The Office was particularly noteworthy because, at that time, critics and audiences alike were not crazy about it. He just trusted Greg and Steve and knew it was worth standing by. Kevin is also very, very handsome, ridiculously handsome. He looks like the guy they'd cast to play network executive on a terrible but fun-to-watch TV show. More important, I really liked what Kevin liked. Network executives usually have bad taste. It's either just a reflection of what market research tells them the normal people are into, or whatever their adolescent children are obsessed with. I have so often been on the receiving end of whatever powerful network executive's children are watching that week. That is when I get calls telling me that I should write an arc in my show for the singer Austin Mahone. Howard sent the pilot script to Kevin, and he and his team read it immediately. I got a call that he would like to see me the following day. Call me superficial, or call me a genius, or call me both. Why can't both be true? But before the meeting, I went to the MAC store to get my makeup done, then to Dry Bar in Sunset and got a blowout. I wanted Kevin and his team at Fox to see me as a potential star of a network TV show. They didn't need to see my large pores or my 40 sad strands of witch hair. They wanted big, bouncy, shiny, two broke girls hair. I drove to the Fox lot across town, parked, drank two shots from a bottle of Jose Cuervo that I keep on the floor of my passenger seat, arranged my breasts so it looked like I had filled in a solid B cup, dissolved enough Listerine breath strips on my tongue so the inside of my mouth was burning, and raced across the lot, hoping not to run into Rupert Murdoch and my kids. A note about me, I wear kids to every meeting and then go to the restroom and change into my slutty career women's stilettos before I actually see anyone important. I was joined at the meeting by Bella Bajaria, the head of Universal Television Studios. I was very lucky that Bella was so supportive and determined to sell the show somewhere other than NBC. But she was also my boss, and her presence made me even more nervous. "You'll be great. You know what you're doing," Bella said warmly to me, a perfect stranger, while we waited to see Kevin. I nodded, grateful, while privately dying inside. How does she know I'll be great? I've never pitched a show before. I get nervous when I tell anecdotes. Sometimes I accidentally blurt the ending right in the middle. Also, I'm sweating. Do great people sweat so much that their thighs stick to the leather sofas they're sitting on? I unstuck myself and went into Kevin's office. The good news. Kevin was cheerful and open about how much he liked the script. His super handsome face was glowing with handsomeness. But he wasn't won over yet. He had some very specific notes that he wanted me to address. The notes were about making sure that the character of Danny Castellano was strong and masculine. He didn't want my character to outsmart him and push him around all the time. So I had a pretty tough assignment. One of my very worst qualities is how impatient I am, but it's actually very helpful when I am rewriting. I skipped out of the Fox lot, threw my kids back on, resisted the temptation to go over to the Simpsons building and take selfies with the Bart Simpson topiary, and raced to the car to take another shot of Cuervo for my drive home. This time, a celebratory one. For the next 3 days, I worked nonstop. There is a certain type of greasy hair that you get only when you are writing with no breaks, and I had it, big time. If I breathed in deeply, I could smell my unwashed scent, and it was intoxicating. It smelled like hard work. You know on Game of Thrones how Khal Drogo always looked powerful and dirty, because he'd been marauding nonstop for weeks? That's how I pictured myself. I was Khal Drogo on this pilot. My fingers were my Dothraki Khalasar. And Kevin Riley was my Khaleesi. For I was going to make him slash her mine slash Drogo's. This metaphor is getting belabored. I turned in the script to Bella and the rest of the studio. They signed off on it and sent it to Kevin. I waited. 2 days later, Kevin called me. He said he wanted to shoot it. He didn't even use a sports metaphor, like, "I'm putting your script into the game." He just said it. But in truth, my Hail Mary pass had just been caught in the end zone just as the last seconds ticked off the clock. I just looked up those terms online. I was so excited, and I was really scared. I no longer worked at the office. I was going to have a new office. My office. The No Longer Untitled Mindy Project, slash The Titled Mindy Project. Originally, in my pilot script, I had named my character Mira. But Kevin told me to change it to Mindy. This made me nervous. Ultimately, the note was the best advice, okay, order, that Kevin ever gave me. By having the lead character share my name, it lent an authenticity to the show that people really responded to. Jerry Seinfeld kept his first name Jerry in Seinfeld, and it made you feel like you were his pal too, and that he wasn't trying to add distance between the viewer and his point of view. Calling her Mindy also inadvertently helped to make me more famous. My real first name was on TV listings and billboards and radio ads across the country. Now, whenever I see a Subway ad for the Mindy Project, I can't believe it's my actual name on there, and I get so excited, even if my face has been vandalized with a Hitler mustache, because that's how you know you truly made it. I had finally done it. I had created a show. Not for Musty TV, home of Cheers and Friends, but for Fox, home of Married with Children and Joe Millionaire. You never quite get everything you want the way you want it. But here I was, a showrunner and TV star, so who cared? Nothing bad would happen to me now. The end. Not so fast, Big Shot. 4 years later, after 3 seasons, Fox canceled the Mindy Project. The day it was canceled, I was in Montana, on the first vacation I had taken in 7 years. When I heard the news about the show, I was floating down the Blackfoot River. I was incredibly surprised.